Good morning, everyone. So I think this is our fifth class of Sha'ar Gemul. I know last week we missed each other because it was Tisha B'Av, but not to worry, we'll pick up right where we left off. So just before we go into the sources themselves, let's just back up and let's review what we did before. We talked about different categories of people, and depending on if you're a majority sin, majority good deeds, what kind of sins you committed, there's different gradations of punishment. So we mentioned that many people go to Gehenna for a little bit. We mentioned that people who are exceedingly wicked, they go to Gehenna and they go to hell for 12 months, not 11 months. And we said that that actually answers the question of, for anyone who's said Kaddish for a parent before, why you stop saying Kaddish at the end of the 11th month, even though you're still in mourning for 12 full months. Because we believe that someone who is a decent person after 11 months, they leave Gehenna and they're purified from their sins. So now let's share the screen and we'll continue with the final category, which, if memory serves me, I think Susan had a question about people who are just so terrible that it seems like going to hell even just for 12 months is insufficient, right? Was that the question you brought up last time, Susan? Okay, well, we'll assume that that it
Forever.
was. What was that? You're muted again.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, don't understand why they're not in Gehenna forever if they're
Great.
really evil.
Okay, so this is the sixth and final category, which is what Susan, I believe you are referring to.
Oh, good.
But heretics and apostates, those who deny our Torah, those who deny the revival of the dead, those who have abandoned the congregation, who have abandoned the Jewish people. Essentially, they place their lot in this world. And they cut themselves off from the next world. Then what about wealthy? There are wealthy people, powerful people in positions of authority, who impose fear on their constituents, upon those that they lord over. Not for the sake of heaven. He says non-Jewish kings, but in theory, it could be a wicked Jewish king as well, because if we study the books of Kings, Sefer Malachim, there's probably more wicked kings than there are good kings. Even if he's an okay king, he sets okay policies, reasonable taxes, he makes sure that you can't go rampant through the streets and murdering and raping, God forbid, or prostitution or any other major issue. He keeps things relatively ethical, but but instead of encouraging his constituents to worship God, he encourages them only to perform good deeds for the sake of serving himself. And then also those who sin and cause others to sin, who lead congregations astray. So think of someone like, it's more like a Navi Sheker, false prophet, but like Shabtai Tzvi. So he led huge groups of Jews astray, believing that he was the Messiah. Or the wicked king Yeravam ben Nevat, who led Jewish people, his people astray. Kol elu yardin leGehenem. They go down to Gehenna. They go down to hell. V'ni dunim ba. This is the key term for Susan. Ledore doros, for generations and generations.
Good.
Shenemar vayatsu uru b'figrei hanashim. There's a footnote blocking. Haposhim bi ki tolasam lo tamus v'asham lo sichbe. So they will never, it'll never be put out, it'll never be extinguished. So it sounds like they are going to be put down into Gehenim, and there they will remain for generations upon generations upon generations. So there's the sixth category of people who are considered the most vile and wicked people possible. And we'll get back to the king in a moment, to people in positions of authority. But these people are so terrible, they go down for generation to generation to generation, not just for 12 months. We'll see in a moment how we understand what that means. What's that mean, generation to generation? Is that literally for 4 generations, 10 generations, but eventually they make it out? Or is that just a way of saying that they go down forever and they never rise from Gehenna? Anyway, I just want to finish this section because we've been on it for a little bit, so we'll get to the notes in a moment. So this is what the rabbis refer to when they say there are 3 categories of people for Judgment Day. Yom Moed Hula Dunah Kol. Everyone gets judged on this day. Ushakasav Alav Yom Hashem HaGadol VaHaNora. This is a great and awesome day. V'Yom Uzmam Etchias Olam Haba. And this marks the beginning of the world to come. So on this great judgment day, this is when this marks the beginning of the transition from the messianic period into the world to come. Ubo Shania B'Perek Chelek. This is found in Perek Chelek in Gemara and Sanhedrin. Dor Hamabel Elam Chelek Lom Haba. The men and all the people who lived during the times of the Mabel, the deluge, the great flood. Ve'enam Omdin B'Din. They will not stand in judgment. They go straight down. Anshei Sodom Elam Chelek Lom Haba. Aval Omdin B'Din. But Anshei Sodom, they get to be judged on that day. But they go straight down to Gehenna. They don't have a portion in the world to come. This is what we are referring to in this whole section when we say there are 3 categories of people that go down, that are judged on Yom HaDin. As you can see, we just finished this section. So let me just contextualize for a moment, then we'll go into the footnotes in a moment. The Ramban is a little bit out of order when it comes to the chronology. The chronology is that there is a judgment day on Rosh Hashanah when someone is alive. Then what we're going to talk about probably in next year, not this one, we're not going to get to it, is judgment Hadin Bishas Hamisa. You can see the header for the next section. It's judgment day when someone dies. And what we just talked about, the section we finished, is really step number 3, though it's put in the middle, is the great day of reckoning, which comes for everyone, even if they died already, at the end of days when God is ready to bring everyone to Olam Haba, to the world to come. So I want to just, any questions on the chronology? I just want to make sure that that's clear, the series of events. That's just important to know for a general understanding of what we're delving into. Anyway, if there are no questions, I want to go back to something. See if we could rewind a little bit. So we talked about how there are these kings, these men in positions of authority, who they impose their will upon people, and they do so. They may even, their laws might be ethical laws in line with the Torah's conception, but if their intention is to get the people not to worship God and perform mitzvahs for God, but to worship the king or the Lord, whoever is in position of authority himself, they're put in the worst category possible. And I don't know about you, that struck me as a little odd. That struck me as a little over the top. Because, don't we say, after all, that if you perform a mitzvah, shelo lishma, that if you get people, even if they're not performing mitzvos for the sake, because I'm doing it because HaKadosh Baruch Hu asked me to do it, there still should be some reward. It shouldn't be so bad to the extent that you go down to Gehenna Ludore, Doros, or generation to generation. You're getting them to do good things after all. The reasoning is not perfectly in line, but you shouldn't be that bad. Maybe you go down for 12 months, 11 months, Ludore, Doros, or generation to generation. Is anyone else troubled by that? Or do we think that this is a a commensurate punishment for the person I just described. Am I the only one who is taken aback by that? Does anyone else think that this is disproportionate to the sin that he committed?
Well, we kind of have a standard way of thinking that people of higher position or higher responsibility or higher respect, more is expected of them. So then you would expect that the punishment would be more stringent if they deviate.
Okay. You know what? That actually, I didn't consider that, but I think that makes a good point, which is they're higher standards. If you are given a position of authority, there are higher standards for how you are expected to conduct yourself. If you are a senator, a governor, a president, whatever it might be, there are presumably higher standards for how you're supposed to conduct yourself than a regular civilian in a country. So too over here, there's a higher standard. I hear that.
Rabbi, I would also suggest that the way he has led could mean that a person who normally would, let's say, be good, then learns from him how to be bad, and he might go get even worse and perhaps cause such damage that's way beyond what normally would have occurred, so that this king, the leader, has really caused much more evil than he himself ever anticipated.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I think I understand what you're saying. It's like, let's say the rabbi makes it to davening, and 30 seconds before davening starts, then someone's gonna say, "Oh, if the rabbi can make it 30 seconds before it starts, I can make it 30 seconds afterwards, and I could come in 5 minutes later and not come in." Right? Is that like that kind of thing? So if the leader has to hold themselves to a higher standard, what they are doing may be technically okay, but they're expected to go beyond the standards in order so because we assume people who are not in their position are not going to reach that standard that they set. So whatever you do, they're going to do less. So I agree with that. Let's take a look at this footnote over here. So I was bothered by the question when I first read the Ramban, but let me show you an answer to this question, which actually I found very compelling. You'll tell me if you find it equally compelling as I do. Lefize. Haparnes hagorin letzibur lasa vodasim shelo lishma. Mafsin mehem. Oh, sorry. Let me back up actually a little bit. Let's look at the right paragraph right before. Haramban kosev kan tam acher lechetze. Vusha al yedei ze atzibur mischamen de yosei maasin la vodasa v'la vados adon hakol. What's the issue here? This lord, this king, is getting his people not to serve God, but to serve him. That's where their intentions lie. So all he's doing is just removing the lishma factor. They're not performing mitzvos for the sake of God. So what does Ramban write? That we actually learned this before, I think maybe two classes ago, that when you perform a mitzvah only for the sake of reward in this world, God just gives you reward in this world. You don't get your reward in the world to come. But if you perform mitzvahs with either for this, purely because you want to serve God, or alternatively because you want reward in the next world, which is a tier below, but it's still good, you get reward not only in this world, but your principle, the main reward, waits for you in the world to come. So based on this premise that we learned previously, that we're rehashing here, when this parnes, this authority figure, encourages his constituents to serve, to perform mitzvos, shalolishma, not for the sake of God, what's he actually doing to them? He's making them lose out on the reward that they would have gotten in the world to come had they done it for the right reason. And this is beautiful. It's poetic justice. He gets punished with the same measure that he inflicted. Meaning, if he is encouraging people not to serve, not to minister God, but to do it to serve him, he's essentially saying, do it shalolishma, not for the sake of God, which then does what? It means they don't get the reward in the world to come. And if he's the one who's causing it not to get the reward in the world to come, it's only right, it's only just that it reciprocates. And he does not get a portion in the world to come because he caused other people to squander their potential portions in the world to come. What do we make of that? Does that sits a lot better with me. It's not just simply, I did something really bad, so now I don't make it into the world to come. It's not necessarily the severity. It's not that he, had the most malicious intent, but he caused other people not to go to the world to come. So he loses his portion of the world to come. That's one answer that's provided to our question. Another one I want to show you, which also I also found to be a compelling answer, is we had to dive deeper into the philosophy of serving this man over serving God. The Chazniha, Rav Avram Yosef HaKohen Shlita, so he's quoting one of his relatives here, son-in-law. Here she is the farish kavanah she osa mitzvos mipnei she ben adam mitzavuhu lo mitakabas ol shemayim hareze prikas ol malchu shemayim. What's actually going on here? We misunderstood the premise. When a king or authority figure encourages his constituents not to serve God for the right reasons, in order to serve himself, that's not called them serving shelo lishma. That's even below that. They are shirking off the yoke of heaven, of God, and in place of God, they worship this man, this authority figure, this king or lord as their new deity. This isn't, innocuous. I'm just doing a mitzvah, but I don't have the right intentions, but I still get rewarded. This is worse. This is, you're not performing the mitzvos for God, you're performing the mitzvos for this king. So when you perform these mitzvos, you're actually shirking off your responsibility and your fidelity to God. Instead, you basically bend the knee and swear fealty to this king instead. That's what he says. Okay, so Rav Lazar Man Shach says the same. Why do we perform mitzvahs? Because God commanded us. Here we're not accepting the yoke of heaven, the yoke of God. We're accepting the yoke of a man. This is shirking and throwing off God's yoke. This brings us really close to essentially performing idolatry. And this is something that happens very often, not very often, but it's something, has anyone here ever read Yishayo Leibowitz at all? So Yishayo Leibowitz, you may have heard of Nechama Leibovich. She was a very big Tanakh scholar. Her brother is Yishayo Leibowitz. He was a polymath. He was a huge genius, a philosopher among many things. And what he liked to say all the time was that he accused people of idolatry. That was his big thing he flung around. He famously considered the state of Israel to have become an idol to many people, that instead of prioritizing focusing on God, they focused the state of Israel became their new deity. That was his big claim. But it wasn't only in the realm of Israel, it was in the realm of many other areas as well. Just Israel was a new state at the time, and that was naturally a bigger focus in the discourse of the Jewish people. So what's going on here? It's a Yishayahu Leibovich-esque accusation. That instead of worshiping God, you are in truth worshiping this man. And I don't know, for anyone who was on for my sermon interview many, many months back. Wow, it's a long time ago. I shared a story about someone, a man who refused to eat on Yom Kippur, even though it would be fatal to him. And the rabbi said, if you refuse to eat on Yom Kippur when it's contrary to your health, that's actually, you're not worshiping God, because God wants you to eat on Yom Kippur in this case, but you're worshiping the Yom Kippur God. You create this new deity called the Yom Kippur God that you worship. So it's actually very important to a certain extent that it's okay, sometimes if we don't have in mind, I'm doing it fully l'shem shemayim for the sake of Hashem. It's not ideal, but you're not a bad person for that. It's still okay. But if you're doing a mitzvah for the sake of someone else other than God, to appease someone else, then that's replacing God with a new being that you're worshiping. So that is very close. That comes very close to Avodah Zarah. And this man, and actually that's what kings did. That was, what's it called? Mandate of heaven. That's what I remember from my social studies classes, where kings would claim to be chosen by divine origin, or like Paro, like Pharaoh in the stories in Egypt of the Jewish people, he considered himself to be a deity to a certain extent. That's the whole story, of course, if we ever heard, where Moshe saw Paro using the facilities and he tried to make people think that he was a god. So kings actually tried to do that. And they tried to replace themselves with the actual god. V'zeh garmi shelo lishma. This is worse than shelo lishma. Sha'asam osa avodas l'shel makom v'achshe mechavim l'schar. This is what shelo lishma. I perform mitzvahs for God, but I do it for reward, not for God himself. Aval v'zeh etzem avoda eina avodas hamakom. But this kind of worship is not worship of God. It is worship of someone else. This is exactly what the Ramban said above, that they're not doing it to worship Hashem, they're doing it to worship someone else. Now we understand why this man has no portion in the world to come. He took away the Ol Machu Shemayim, the dedication of God from the Jewish people. The view is that Sibur Levodas, and he brought the congregation to his own service. So if there's any sin that's going to wind you up in hell, idolatry is going to be it. And this man not only encouraged idolatry, but he turned himself into an idol and encouraged everyone to worship himself instead of God.
Very interesting.
Yeah. And, you know, look, there's definitely a more moral sermon message to be given here, which is, you know, I'm not going to sermonize right now on all of you, but essentially, I wonder sometimes when we have to be thankful to different political figures who speak on behalf of the Jewish people, who speak on the behalf of Israel and support our existence and our welfare. But I, you know, sometimes I get very concerned when we put them on such a high pedestal that we almost worship them over worshiping God themselves. So I'm not going to mention any names of particular politicians. I'm sure for those who are of a Republican bent, you're thinking of some Democrats. Some of the Democrats amongst are thinking of some Republicans. And it's really true both ways. The important part is to be build connections and be appreciative with community leaders, with politicians in an expedient manner, in a pragmatic manner, but ultimately understanding that God is the one who pulls the strings, and that's who we owe our allegiance to above all else. So that's the important idea here. Okay, we're at 9:42. You know, let me just pause for a moment. Were there any questions just on this section before we move forward?
I have a question.
Yes,
okay, it's not just, let's say, leaders of countries, and it's not just politicians, but what about religious leaders who ultimately make the decisions for their communities? I mean, where do you place those kind of people?
So that, you know, actually, I think your point's very well taken. Religious leaders is where this is most likely going to happen, where a religious leader makes it less about serving God, but more about the leader himself. And, you know, you can kind of go, there's some TV shows with, you know, this is among Jews also, but I guess in America we see it among pastors. I was talking with someone, I think I mentioned to you, like every now and then we have students from universities reach out, they want to interview either Rabbi Cohen or myself to ask questions about Judaism for their reports. So this Christian fellow, he was lamenting to me that there are many pastors, they have these TV shows and these mega churches, and they have this huge congregation coming to listen to them, but he gets the sense that they're there more to hear the pastor. They like him as an order, they think he's charismatic, but they're not really there so much for God, they're there to worship the pastor himself. And unfortunately, that's not limited to other religions. We have it in Judaism as well. And definitely, you know, for me, there is a concern. Obviously, if someone is a good orator, someone has a good personality, it definitely helps, but it has to be a tool. It has to be a means to an end of teaching God's Torah and ultimately bringing people to worship God. if it ever becomes a cult of personality and becomes more about the clergy figure, about the rabbi, more so than it is about God, you know we're going in a very bad direction. And I wouldn't be surprised if Ramban would include someone like that in this category as well. Because, you know, you could be a big fan of a political leader, but ultimately, you know, he's a politician. You're not going to confuse him with your religion. Some people do, but that's a different point. But when it comes to religion itself and religious figures, people are more likely to confuse and conflate the religious figure with God himself. And that's where it becomes most likely to happen, most dangerous. And I appreciate you bringing that up because that's, well, I guess important for people like me and my my line of work to keep that in mind too. So holding us true, Susan.
Rabbi,
yes, Audrey.
You're coming from Far Rockaway, close to the five towns. There have been many, many instances where the rabbis of many of the congregations within the five towns would get up and say, "You are not to solicit or purchase from this and this business, or you are not to go to this particular institution." They are known for that. For many, many years. Yes.
Right. So, I mean, you know, definitely, I think, you know, you bring up a an important issue. I'm not sure if it's exactly what we're discussing, which is if rabbis overstep their boundaries and try to control the community according to what they like, even when
what they were trying to do.
So I don't know if that's true for the, you know, obviously I don't want to talk specifics about any particular communities.
No.
It's very, very wonderful.
That's
rabbis
the whole general area.
I'm sure there's a lot of wonderful.
I'm familiar with it. Yeah, I'm familiar with that particular area. That's
right. So there's a lot of wonderful people in the five towns.
Absolutely. Definitely. Many, many wonderful people. Yes.
Right.
Yes.
But I agree with you in principle that if religious figures abuse their authority, that's problematic. It says in Pirkei Avos that if a rabbi abuses the Keser Torah and they abuse the you know, the honors that come along with it, God will hold them accountable for it. So it's, you know, that's also, you know, good. We have Susan, we have yourself. I'm getting a lot of good mustard today. Things for me to keep in mind as I'm starting my career in the rabbinate. So I'm glad I have you all here to hold me true. This is what I need to hear.
We're watching. Don't worry.
Okay. Okay. We're running a little low on time. So let me try to just... We finished this section in the Ramban. I just want to finish some of the ideas that the Chazon Yoel, the commentary, brings up. And then next time, God willing, we'll start the next section, which I have prepared and ready to jump into. So another question that comes up is, there is a statement by the Gemara that says, one day Gehenom will be extinguished. Gehenom, hell, will... I don't know, freeze over, however you want to imagine it, but hell will be no more. But wait a minute. Didn't we just say that there are Rishayim, there are wicked people that are so terrible, so vile, so wicked, that they go down for generation to generation forevermore? So how could hell one day be gone, but these Rishayim, these wicked men and women are still being punished and suffering in it? There's some sort of contradiction going on here. So the Marsha just asks this question and he leaves it that way. But the Ritva tries to reconcile how there could be no hell, but there could be people suffering in hell at the same time. So he says, what does it mean that hell stops? It means eventually Gehenom stops, but you have to add, it's missing a few words. Rather, hell stops for the people that aren't there forever, but the people who are there, Ladore Doros, Enim Kolim, it's never gone, and it continued to be weakened and to suffer from being in hell for all of eternity. That's the approach of the Ritva. However, we're going to skip a little bit just so we could cover this whole piece. The Aruch Laner, this is an Achro now, we're moving forward in the years. So the Aruch Laner says, "What does it mean? No, hell stops completely. even for the people who went down for all eternity. Aye, what does it mean that they're going to suffer for all generations and generations to come? What it means is that they will still suffer humiliation. It'll be written all over them that they are sinful people. As it says in the Brisa, Eila Cherpos Ledron Olam. And the fact that for all of eternity, they have to walk with, what's it like, a scarlet letter, a scarlet A on them, saying that they're a sinner. So they are. That is a punishment inherently, that they have to walk around with that humiliation for all of eternity. And then he says, L'chora, this is the same thing that's mentioned by Rabbeinu Yonah. When it comes to, you know, in life we say time heals everything. So if you did something really embarrassing one time, whatever it may have been, you know, you left your Zoom mic on while you were having a private conversation with someone else and the entire shiur heard you. So, you know, everyone will forget it one day. You know, more embarrassing things will take longer. But time heals when it comes to physical matters. But if you are humiliated because of a sin you committed to God, that kind of humiliation never will dissipate, and that will remain with them forever. So according to the Aruch HaNer, even these terrible sinners will go down for generation to generation to generation. They'll suffer in hell for a long time. And even one day when they ascend from it, when hell is gone, when Gehenna is gone, they will still, for all eternity, suffer the punishment of humiliation of walking around with that scarlet letter, with that sign on them that says, I am a sinner, and that will be a form of humiliation. And Rabbi Akiva Eiger says something very similar. There is a medrash, a gata in Nedarim, I believe, that says, "Ein gehenem lasid lavo." There is actually no hell in the world to come. What happens? Ela kadosh baruch hu motzi chama min artika, tzadikim misrapim ba v'shem nidonim ba. God brings out this hidden light, brings out the sun, and shines it upon everybody. So the righteous will benefit from the sunlight, and the wicked, they will perish. They'll be judged by it. They'll perish in the sunlight. What does that mean? So it means, I'll tell you what I was told growing up. What they'd like to tell us in Darchi all the time was that the afterlife is a big base medrash. So the where you sit and you learn Torah all day. So the people who are righteous, they'll enjoy learning Torah, and the people who are wicked, it'll just be like they're back in high school again, and they'll hate it. So it's that same idea that the righteous and the wicked are actually in the same place, and they're exposed to the same variables, the same factors. They are exposed to that same sunlight, but the righteous benefit from it, whereas the wicked perish from it. So the righteous are sitting, they're learning Torah all day, and the wicked are suffering. I meant to ask them, I was like, so according to you guys that you don't let women learn Gemara or do, you know, learn all the Torah, so, you know, what are they doing in the base medrash all day? You know, are they able to learn then? Oh, is that Audrey?
They're always good.
They're already on the high madrig, on the high level, well, right?
And stay there, yes.
Right, but what are they doing? I mean, I guess they chazer Tanakh a bunch of times. They review Tanakh. That's, well, Baruch Hashem, we have more options.
They're figuring out ways to torment you guys.
All right. And Rakita Eger says, similar idea to the Aruch HaNer, that this light will be, what's this light do? It's not a physical light. It's a light that shines the truth upon the deeds of those men and women that are, it's being shined upon. For the righteous, it reveals their righteous deeds. It reveals their good actions and all of the pious things that they've done throughout their lives. And the wicked, it puts the spotlight on all of the terrible actions and deeds that they committed. And so, similar idea to the Aruch HaNer, What happens in hell is that eventually you're no longer suffering from the fires of hell and Gehenna, but you will suffer humiliation from now and forevermore. So that is another approach. However, there is one other approach, which says Sheyeshal Derech Acheres B'Dori Dor. It's another interpretation. It's found on Asar Ma'amaros. Shekasav Ahayinu Dala Doros B'Kenav V'Lo Yoser. What's it mean, Dori Doros? Dori Doros is literally four generations. So hell stops eventually, and these wicked people, they don't go down for 11 months, they don't go down for 12 months, but they go down for four generations. That's a really long time. Masha Amru Gehenim Kalev Heim Enim Kalev. What's it mean that hell will stop, but they don't? Hulu Tovasam Lusuchusam. This is for their merits. Sheyish Gvul V'Sof La'Onesh Gehenim. There is eventually an end to suffering in Gehenim. And then eventually they get to go, they don't necessarily go to heaven. I mean, they don't get the same level as a righteous person, but they get to discontinue their suffering, which I'll tell you, I find that to be a little more compelling, and you'll tell me if you agree or not, because people commit terrible, terrible deeds in this world. But in the end of the day, even if our minds can't fathom it, there is a limit to how much evil they committed. So punish them commensurate to what they did in the afterlife, but an eternity of punishment cannot clearly outweighs any finite evil that they committed in this world. So it makes sense to me that there has to be some form of a limitation to how much suffering one has in the world to come, if they only performed finite evil in this world. And I think that is really the motivation behind this interpretation. And it fits well with the Gemara that says that eventually Gehenna has to come to an end. So just to summarize, we had a contradiction. If hell stops, how are there people suffering in hell for all eternity? We gave some answers, say, Ein Achinami, hell continues for those people. That was approach number one, the Ritva. Approach number two was that hell stops, but they suffer for all eternity because of the humiliation that they experience. And then approach number three is that, no, you know, they committed a finite amount of evil. They get a finite amount of punishment in the world to come, in hell. And it may even be more than commensurate to the evil they committed. Who knows? Maybe it's kefil. Maybe it's nalveh. It could be two, four, five times the amount. But eventually it comes to an end. And even the very wicked people of sixth category that we mentioned, according to some opinions, there is an end to their suffering, to their punishment.
Well, I'm not happy with that, because you take Hitler, that it should be never ending. I can't see any way of that ever being a finite punishment for him.
Definitely. And I definitely agree with that intuition of yours on it. So the interesting thing when it comes to philosophy, every now and then you see a person use the term posak or posake. The funny thing is, when it comes to halacha, we make decisions. There has to be a normative opinion. Even if there is an argument in the Talmud, we need to decide what the practice of our community is. We have to come to consensus. Philosophy, you don't poskin, because either God decides that they will suffer for all eternity, or God decides they'll suffer for four generations or a finite amount of time. So, you know, obviously, I'm very much inclined to what you're saying, Susan, when it comes to someone like Hitler. But I guess at the end of the day, it's something we'll have to wait to find out and see what God ultimately has in store. But it would be very disturbing to know that he gets let off the hook at a certain point. Someone as wicked as that, we don't want to see let off the hook. So I definitely understand where you're coming from. Okay, I think we're at the end here. Are there any final thoughts, commentaries, or questions? I think Toby was trying to say something.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, in accordance with Susan, that maybe when all of this was written, they couldn't even imagine somebody like Hitler. And maybe if the Shara Gemul was being written today, or, you know, some of these commentaries, maybe it would have been, I don't know, maybe they'd do it differently.
Right.
They'd have a fourth category.
Right, maybe an additional category. You know, that's
Rabbi,
the thing.
Rabbi. What did you say in one of the previous sessions? There are some answers that are never answered or never given. Some questions that are never answered.
Right, right. So definitely, you know, that's the, and that was part of our introduction during our first class, that there are certain things that we'll never be able to get a precise answer on. But Ramban later on in Shar HaGemul, he says that it's still incumbent upon us to try to delve as deep as possible and try to make sense of it to the best of our ability, full understanding that we're not privy to everything. So that's what we try to do during this class. Obviously, I can't give you any definitive answers on every question we have. And that's why he tried to write this section of the book to address these questions to the best of his ability. But a few times throughout the book, Ramban himself will actually admit that at a certain point it's speculation, but he bases himself on verses from the Tanakh and passages from the Talmud. And based on that, he tries to create a systematic formulation based on our tradition. And that's what I'm trying to hopefully teach and share with all of us here during our classes. So, okay, thank you, everyone. As you can see, next time we are going to move on to the next section, which talks about the judgment when someone dies. We're actually going to try to go pretty quickly through this section, even though it's a long one. I'm going to try to read through it fast. That way, we get to the next section, which talks about, which delves much deeper into Nisyonos, where God gives us challenges, even if we aren't deserving of the punishment, which I think is very fascinating. It talks about how God punishes those, punishes people out of love. It's called Yisur Shel Ahava. And I think there's a lot to cover and discuss there. So next time we'll try to get through this whole entire section, or maybe in two classes. And okay, so God willing, we'll see you all next Thursday, 9:15 a.m. And thank you all for coming. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you.
Thank you.